From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on August 14th, 2014, in Ferguson, Missouri. It was 5 days after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson. That shooting sparked unrest, and it opened a national conversation about whether people of color are treated differently by law enforcement. As the demonstrations in Ferguson grew, the St. Louis County Police resorted to measures that were heavily criticized. They arrested some reporters, including Wesley Lowery of the Washington Post. Governor Jay Nixon said that police had contributed to the streets looking like a war zone, and so he announced that the Missouri State Highway Patrol would take over policing in Ferguson. That would be led by Captain Ron Johnson, an African-American with roots in the community. Almost immediately, the tone changed, and the night of August 14th, Captain Johnson walked with demonstrators during a large, peaceful march. Writing for the New York Times 10 days later, columnist Dan Barry wrote, quote, "Captain Ronald Johnson, in many days of working to restore calm here in Ferguson, has redefined leadership in crisis. Equal parts police official, preacher, mediator, and neighbor, unafraid to convey his inner conflict, unafraid to cry," end quote. Captain Johnson's voice continues to be a prominent one as this country evaluates how law enforcement builds relationships with communities. And today he's in Rochester. He's a guest at the Baden Street Settlement. He'll provide a fireside chat this evening at 6:30, and then he'll deliver the keynote at the Baden Street Settlement annual luncheon tomorrow. The focus is on lessons from Ferguson. We're honored to have Captain Ronald Johnson on Connections here. Captain, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm honored.
And also here is Mark Simmons. He's a member of the board of the Baden Street Settlement. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Brief interruption from our colleague Juan Vasquez, and Juan, an important day, halfway through the week or so of our spring membership campaign.
Yeah, and we're going to make this quick, too, because we want to really get into this conversation. And the fact that we're able to bring these types of conversations to you, the fact that you will have a chance to be as part of this conversation when you call the show a little bit later on, is all because of listeners like you, folks that make their pledges of support. And you can do so as well. You can head on over to WXXINews.org. You can go to WRUR.org, or you can go to WEOS.org, and you can make your pledge of support there.
All right, one more time, the phone number, sir?
The phone number, it's...
Wait a second.
Yeah, it's right behind
me. Wait a second,
yeah.
I'm in trouble here, because we're supposed to do the website during the show.
We should.
I don't ever listen.
Let's just,
I never listen.
That's okay, but if you go to...
WXXINews.org.
And WEOS.org, WRUR.org, you can go over to the sites over at the top right of the page. You'll see a donate button. Click that, and there you go.
Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
Thank you for bailing me out there. As we said, Captain Ron Johnson, you have seen, listeners, you've probably seen his work, whether you understood exactly who I was introducing or not. You saw the work. And if you remember those days after Ferguson, after the shooting of Michael Brown and what was happening, you know, a lot of us have images in our mind of those first few days. And so much of what I've read about Captain Johnson starts with, you know, the 13th, the 14th, and then going forward as the tone kind of changed. But, Captain, I want to ask you, you know, what were you thinking as you watched what was happening on August 10th, August 11th, August 12th, in those immediate hours after Michael Brown died?
Well, you know, I saw buildings on fire in the community, and I looked at that and said, how are we going to put out this fire? And not from a fireman's standpoint, but from a citizen, from a father and a son and someone who had grew up in a neighborhood, I knew it was going to be a tough time for our community.
We're going to get back to Ferguson in a moment, but first I want to discuss something that happened that I read about when you were 16 years old. You were driving home one night, trying to get home before curfew, and you hit someone's mailbox. Is that right?
That is correct.
And a lot of people at that point would probably, in the hurry to get home, not face the wrath of their parents, would say, sorry, I wiped out that mailbox, I got to keep going. You did not do that. What did you do?
Well, I went home and woke up my father and told him that I had struck a mailbox. And I left a note on that mailbox with my name and phone number. And I told them that I would return tomorrow with my father, because I knew the minute I told him, he'd say we would go back. And so the next day, we went back to that home.
And you went back to that home, and what was the response of the person who owned the mailbox?
The gentleman was so amazed that I left a note and that I truly came back. And he told us not to worry about the mailbox and that he would fix it, just because of that honesty.
The reason I bring up this story is, your mother, in interviews I've seen, have said she knew this was the right career for you, that you were always someone who understood right and wrong from early on. Do you think it's in your DNA? You think it comes from your upbringing? Where does that come from?
Well, you know, people ask me doing Ferguson where I got my leadership skills from, and initially I didn't have an answer. And one night of driving home after being up all night in Ferguson, at about 3:30 in the morning, I called my mother, And I told her I'd been asked that question. And I said, at this moment, I realized that my leadership and the character that I have came from her and my father.
Well, it was on display in Ferguson, but some law enforcement leaders have said that, you know, using a show of force and you know, frankly, some of the actions taken by police in those initial hours and days was necessary. Let me read from the Washington Post on that. The Post reports that you made the change of getting rid of the police's riot gear and SWAT trucks, and quote, the Washington Post writes, quote, Johnson told officers in charge of crowd control to remove their gas masks. He vowed not to blockade the street and ensured residents' rights to assemble and protest would not be infringed upon. And Captain Johnson said, when I see a young lady cry because of fear of this uniform, that's a problem. We've got to solve that, end quote. So, you know, I don't want to ask you to adjudicate everything that your colleagues in other departments have done, but I do think it's fair to ask you, looking back now, were there mistakes made? Is it important to say when you show up in quote-unquote riot gear that provokes a response? Or are there moments where that gear is obviously necessary, and how do you make those decisions?
Well, I think as law enforcement, it's important that the gear and the uniforms that we use, that we take it to our community events where they get a chance to see that and understand why those tools are used. And what I found is that in urban communities, we weren't doing that. And so they saw those things, and they were new. They were fearful of those things. And so I think it was an opportunity to pull back and just show humanity to each other and show some understanding and communicate better.
Was there any concern at the time among the officers who you were working with? Did anyone say to you, look, I know you want to sort of diffuse some of the tension, but we need protective gear. We need this kind of equipment. This is a charged environment here.
And there were times that gear was needed. But initially, people were angry. People had questions. And so I think that there's just a balance that must be used there. And I think officers saw that balance. And our job is to protect people's rights and their freedoms to speak and speak out.
Listeners, if you want to call the program with comments or questions, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Captain Johnson is speaking as a guest of the Baden Street Settlement tonight at 6:30 and then tomorrow at the Baden Street Settlement annual luncheon. And let me ask Mark Simmons, who is a member of the board at the Baden Street Settlement, to let our listeners know if you want to attend, can they? Mark?
Absolutely. We welcome everyone to attend. We're celebrating our 116 years of being the largest settlement house in Greater Rochester. If you would like to attend, you can visit our website at badenstreetsettlement.com, and there's an opportunity to purchase a ticket. The annual luncheon ticket is going to be $50, and we welcome everybody to come out and hear what Captain Johnson has to say.
Okay, and again, how do they get in touch to get tickets?
So they can call Baden Street and visit us at our website, BadenStreetSettlement.com.
Okay, very good. Captain Johnson, you know, broadly speaking, I think it's fair to say that post-Ferguson, not just Ferguson, but I think that event has really galvanized a lot of the discussion about these issues. There are some who would say that the use of that, you know, SWAT gear or whatever the public describes it, I'm sure there might be more technical police terms than riot gear.
Yes.
But the feeling is that is, quote, militarization. That's a term we hear a lot. And that provokes a response. And that, by and large, that is used too often. Do you agree with that generalization?
I think when there's not a partnership, there's not communication, and there's not a relationship, I think that can happen. You know, when we looked at some of the tools that were used in Ferguson, some of the SWAT vehicles, the armored vehicles, when we let people see what was inside of those vehicles and what they really could do and what their purpose was, then people had that understanding. And so I think it's about being transparent in what we do. And I think that's kind of what we saw in Ferguson and in other places across this country, that as law enforcement, we have to be transparent in what we do and open to the community that we're serving and impacting.
So in other words, it sounds like if police departments have that kind of equipment, they would be well served at a time where there is no unrest, to maybe have a public demonstration. Let neighborhoods know. Say, hey, you want to take a look at the truck? You want to see what the gear is? We hope we never have to use it, but if we do, I want you to see what it looks like. Is that kind of what you're saying?
You're exactly right. And whole citizens academies where your citizens come in and see exactly what you do and how you do it.
Okay. Well, I wonder, Mark, as a member of the board of the Baden Street Settlement, do you think that could happen in this community? Is that something that makes sense here?
So what we would like to think that it won't happen in this community, and we would like to take proactive steps to ensure that it doesn't happen.
You mean the actual use of that equipment during a crisis, but I'm more talking about the public demonstrations, the outreach to kind of display.
Absolutely. I know firsthand that the Rochester Police Department provides a citizen police academy that they do typically on an annual basis, sometimes twice a year. They also have community exhibits where they come out and display the SWAT truck and the mm-hmm. scuba truck and have an opportunity for the community to come out and have a look at the apparatus in order to be comfortable with it, because it's there for a purpose of protecting and serving the community.
Okay. Well, Captain Jensen, you know, you chose to march with demonstrators and kind of be visible with them. You know, you're willing to hug people, willing to cry. You know, take me through those days and those hours starting on the night of the 14th in Ferguson, and what that was like for you and why you made that decision after things had kind of taken the turn. Why did you make those decisions? What was it like?
You know, for me, I wanted to feel the emotions of the people that were on the street. I wanted to hear their voice. I think sometimes the people that are in our streets and in our communities feel like they're voiceless and no one hears their voice or sees their face. And I wanted to see their face, and I wanted to hear their voice. And I think by doing that, I could understand, and we could come on a plan together to make our community better and to make this situation something that is going to make our country better.
In Ferguson, did you know by the end of that night on the 14th, you know, 5 days after Michael Brown died, did you get the sense that the tension really had started to wane, that some of your decisions were right? I mean, the next few days, did you see the changes you were hoping for? What was the mentality you had there?
I did. I think when you show humanity toward each other, that only positive can come out of that. And people were telling me that we appreciate you coming out here to listen and show us that we've got purpose and an importance. And so I began to see that immediately.
And so I want to also ask, as we kind of look around the country, we had a night last July where there were maybe a dozen cities around the country that had public demonstrations in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Rochester was one of them. And in some communities, you saw political leaders, you saw mayors, you saw police chiefs marching with demonstrators, sitting on bridges, holding hands, those kinds of things. In other cities, you did not. It was a little bit more of a little bit more tension and a little less visibility among leaders with people. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. I know every town is different and every moment is different. But why do you think we're seeing some places where people are kind of doing what you did? It's kind of following the lead that you set in Ferguson, saying, look, we can't always be afraid. We have to stand arm in arm sometimes, even when it's tense, whereas others are not willing to do that. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think we've been in this moment that we're in for a long time. It is going to take some small steps to get us where we need to be. And in anything, we talk about change. There are some people that will be far out front, and there will be some that will be taking small steps because of fear or because of the unknown. But the way that I look at that, as long as we're stepping forward, we're gaining and we're getting better. So it's going to take time. But we are seeing communities do a lot more, coming together, political leaders, law enforcement. And so I think when I look at the whole, we're taking small steps, but we're moving forward in some small increments.
In some ways, it's an unfair question because, again, town to town, moment to moment, without knowing the details, it's hard to kind of answer this. But generally speaking, do you think leaders of communities need to be there in those moments and say, I'm willing to be there on the front lines. I want to be visible. I want to be seen. I want to interact with people who are frustrated with demonstrators in those moments. Is that important?
It truly is. I think that is the role of a leader, is to step up and be at the forefront. And you may be criticized for that, and negative things may come from that. But I think that's the leader's role, and I think that's what our communities need, for leaders that are going to do that, leaders that are going to stand hand in hand, and then others will follow.
So I want to ask you what you think of the media's coverage. You know, I've read some of what the news media, the New York Times, there's been a lot of praise for your work. But I'm curious to know if you think the media covered Ferguson accurately, not sensationalistically, but appropriately. What do you make of the media's performance? Let's start with Ferguson. How did the media do?
I think overall the media did a good job. I think it was something new for our country we hadn't experienced in a long time. But I think once everybody kind of began to wrap their arms around it, I think the media did a good job. I think we had large crowds that came out doing Ferguson. But I talked to a lot of people that never came out. And the reason they never came out wasn't because they didn't care. It's because the media gave them what they needed to hear and what they needed to know. And so I think our media plays a big role in our country to bring about change. But the media gave people a voice that would have never been heard. And so I think that was important.
When does the media get things wrong when reporting on police-community relations, whether it's Ferguson or the issue more broadly? When do you see the media making mistakes?
I think sometimes when we don't interact together as law enforcement and media, when we don't interact together, sometimes we're not transparent enough to the media, and the media has to come up with their own answer, and vice versa. So I think when the media gets it wrong, sometimes it's because both sides aren't working together in a partnership.
Do you see good faith efforts among journalists to try to report accurately?
I really do. And I tell people that before Ferguson, as a law enforcement officer, I had this fear of the media about not saying the wrong thing. But I will say doing Ferguson, the media became one of my best friends.
Talking to Captain Johnson, who did such remarkable work in Ferguson, he is in Rochester today as a guest of the Baden Street Settlement. And you can hear him and hear what he has to say, whether it's tonight at 6:30 for a fireside chat or tomorrow at Baden Street Settlement's annual luncheon. And so it's a great opportunity there to meet Captain Ronald Johnson and to understand his work that he did at Ferguson and continues to do as we talk about police-community relations around the country. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Gene Denby is an African-American reporter for NPR, and he wrote a piece about the stress and challenge for black reporters who cover, in his words, black death. And Captain Johnson, he writes the following, quote, "Every black Ferguson resident I interviewed in 2014 had his own story about an unfair encounter with local cops. And unsurprisingly, nearly all black journalists I've talked to mentioned a similar story from their off-the-clock lives. Joel at BuzzFeed told me he's been stopped 3 times a year by the police since he started driving 2 decades ago. Charles Blow of the New York Times wrote earlier this year about how his son, a Yale student, had a gun pulled on him by campus police who thought he didn't belong at the school's library, and so on," end quote. And so, Captain Johnson, when I ask political leaders on this program if they think people of color are treated differently by law enforcement, they usually hedge a little. They usually give an answer that says, you know, it can happen, but by and large, law enforcement, you know, is out to do the right thing. And I understand that answer, but I do want to ask you if you think people of color are treated differently by law enforcement in this country.
You know, I think that we have to definitely become more diverse in our police agencies. I think in some of our communities, there's not that understanding that it needs to be. And I think because there's not that understanding that does happen in some of our communities throughout our country, that the encounters are different. And that's why we have to make sure that we're being diverse in our workforce, diverse in our training. But I wouldn't be honest if I was saying that doesn't exist and it doesn't happen.
I'm sure what Gene Denby is saying from the work that he did covering the story in Ferguson and the people he talked to, you've talked to many people in Ferguson too. You hear those stories from residents?
I did hear stories. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was apologize for those. And of course, when you're talking and people are telling you those stories, you can see the honesty in what they're telling you and in their emotions, in their words. And I'd say that we need to do better. But I also say that this badge stands for something that I believe in, and that men and women that wear this badge do a great job across this country and risk their lives and serves our community well. But where we're imperfect, we have to be honest and say that we can do better.
You mentioned the diversity on police forces. I'm going to get back to that in a moment, but I think it's also fair to ask if you'd like to see newsrooms get more diverse. I mean, American journalism, newsrooms are very white, disproportionately white, still are. And we try to acknowledge that and understand what that means. Do you think that impacts coverage? Would you like to see more diversity in media?
I think we need that throughout our country, that we need that diversity. But I also think that our experiences in our life, and I would hate to say that in Ferguson, because there was mostly white journalists, that it wasn't, they didn't report fairly. I think they did. You know, a lot of the journalists were really young. And one thing that I saw in Ferguson, that our young people that were in Ferguson, our young journalists, had a more diverse understanding. They really did. And I think that's why the reporting, I think, was really good there.
I know in Rochester, well, I don't have updated numbers, but I can say that certainly in the months after Ferguson, there was a lot of emphasis on diversity of police forces. And Captain Johnson, I don't remember offhand, but I do recall hearing that the various forces in Ferguson and surrounding area were not very diverse, not as diverse as the population by any means, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And I think in Rochester, there's a lack of diversity that wasn't as sharp. I remember in those months, 25% to 30% officers of color, I think, and I think there's an ongoing effort to increase that number. Chief Simonelli, other leaders in the department have stressed the value of that. Can you tell me why you think that's important? You brought it up on your own here, Captain Johnson, that you want to see more diversity in policing ranks. For those who claim that, we need to not see color, we need to not, overemphasize that and just hire the best people no matter their background, why does it matter to bring more diversity into policing?
Well, I think seeing color is important. I think when we say we don't see color, then we're missing out on the richness of cultures and the experiences that they can bring to the table. But I think when you have diversity within a police department, within the media, then there's conversations within that workforce about different experiences and values. And so now when you go out into the world and go out and apply law or apply whatever your tasks are, you're going to have a different way of doing that because you're experiencing your understanding, the way you're going to interact with those that you encounter.
Another thing that Demby talked about on the journalist side, and I wonder if this is true on the policing side, he has written about the pressure that black journalists have when they are, maybe the only black journalist in a newsroom or the only black journalist covering a certain story, that all of a sudden they're speaking for an entire race. And that's not fair. But when there isn't more diversity, there's this weight that, let's talk to the black journalists and find out, quote, what black people think, as if, you're speaking for the entire race. And that pressure is unfair. It does happen. It can be stressful. It can be depressing. Does it happen to officers of color to feel that weight? When you look around and there aren't other officers of color, do you feel that, wow, there's so much weight on me, because I'm the only officer of color or there are very few? My actions, what I say, might get over-extrapolated. Does that happen?
I think that is a true statement, and I saw that doing Ferguson sometimes. But you see it from both sides. I saw it from the expectations of the fellow officers that wore the uniform, the same uniform as me. But I also saw it from the community. And so there is that added pressure. But I think that you have to be willing to stand up and take that. If you're the only one or if there's a few, you have to be able to stand up and take that and be transparent and true to it. And it may come with some criticism. It may come with some negativity. But I think that that's okay.
We're talking to Captain Ronald Johnson, who was called in to help lead the police response to the unrest in Ferguson 5 days after the shooting of Michael Brown, and he has been widely praised around the country for the work that he did in diffusing some of the tension, but doing so in a way that was, I think a lot of the critics would tell you, appropriate, strong, still valuing importance of police work while also respecting demonstrators and their right to peaceably assemble. And Ronald Johnson is in Rochester today. He's a guest of the Baden Street Settlement. He's speaking tonight and tomorrow. You got a couple chances to see him. We'll talk a little bit more about that in our second half hour. And we'll take some of your comments and phone calls as well if you want to call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This is our only break, and we're right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Jiva is tackling sexual assault in the military with its remarkable production of Other Than Honorable. We'll review it and talk about the themes. Then in our second hour, answering your questions on breast care, breast cancer, health, even questions on preventative mastectomy and what's appropriate. We'll talk about it on Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. Before I grab some of your phone calls, let me grab Juan Vasquez, our colleague from the newsroom, who's popping into the studio during the third day of our spring membership campaign. Hi, Juan.
Hello, Evan. And we're taking just a few moments to ask you to be a member of your public radio station, because you becoming a member allows us to be able to not only bring you Connections, but also to bring you this program and the chances for you to be able to be a part of the conversation, which doesn't happen very often anymore in media. So the chance for you to be a part of the conversation is vital to the public discourse that we're having here. So we want you to be a part of that. You can go to WXXINews.org and make your pledge of support. You can go to WEOS.org, or you can go to WRUR.org. And at the top of each of those pages, you'll find a donate button. There is where you can make your pledge of support and help to continue to bring Connections to you each and every afternoon.
Thanks very much, Juan. Appreciate that. Well, let's continue the discussion and let's grab some phone calls. And I'm going to start with John in Rochester, who's on the line with both Mark Simmons, who's a member of the board of the Baden Street Settlement, and their guest today and tomorrow, Captain Ronald Johnson, who helped lead the police response following the unrest in Ferguson. This is John. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Ron. Ron, do you think looking back on it now, Black Lives Matter, do you think they're hypocritical in that Michael Brown turned out to be the culprit? He turned out to be the criminal, and he was definitely in the wrong. My second question is Baltimore. The Baltimore riots that happened, I believe the police tried to be low-key there, but I don't think it helped. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the Black Lives Matter group was started before the incident with Michael Brown Jr. and Officer Wilson. I think that a lot of other things came out of the days in Ferguson. So I look at everything else that came out of that. But I think the importance of the group is basically saying that we've got some issues in our urban communities. We've got some issues that we need to address throughout this country. I think that is the main focus. So I think when we start picking out different parts of it, it gets lost in what we really need to be addressing is, education and economics and those things. When we get to Baltimore, I think once again, there has to be this community partnership and outreach prior to having incidents like what happened in Baltimore, what happened in Ferguson. I think when we have that partnership and those relationships, then we have a chance to deal with them in a better way.
Didn't the mayor in Baltimore, though, tell the police pretty much to stand down?
And I don't know all the details there, but, it erupted initially. I think there just wasn't that relationship. And I think when policemen can walk into communities and everyone knows each other, when you know who those leaders are, I think like we talked about a minute ago, in some communities, those leaders are known and they're out on the forefront doing the good times. And when things happen, those leaders are there and those leaders have that strong voice that the community will listen to.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you very much.
All right, John, thanks for the phone call. Let's get Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, good afternoon. Question I have, I guess maybe it's kind of a semi-comment. I'm out of a certain age that I remember all of the civil rights marches and the work that was done back in the late 50s and 60s. And it's hard not to kind of despair when you think that there's probably maybe, if my math is correct, at least two generations of law enforcement officers have probably come up through the ranks during that period. And there's times that it just seems, and it goes on both sides. It's certainly not just police officers. It's certainly there's enough concern to go around. It's just interesting to me that you would think with, as I say, the generational shifts, that there should be some more overt change that we could look at. And one other quick comment, it also seems to me that I think the proper term is community policing, policing where the officers are visible and I don't know if on the ground is the correct term, but more a part of the community that they're trying to preserve and protect. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the community policing aspect too. And thank you very much. And I will be donating later too, Evan.
Oh, Paul, that's very kind. Thank you, Paul. Let's work backwards on his questions. Community policing. Captain Johnson?
I think you're dead on. Police have to be a part of the community, whether that's coaching in sports, whether it's at lunchtime, going to those restaurants that you don't normally go to and making sure you're talking to everyone, whether they're young or old, it doesn't matter. And so I think that is truly important because those relationships make a difference. When you get out and you listen to people, the people that believe they don't have a voice. And so that is the key, that we've got to make sure that we're a part of the community, we're known in the community, but we're listening to our community. So that's the key, and I think we're seeing that across this country where police departments that are getting out and being more involved in the community have these stronger relationships, and when they go through tough times, they go through them together.
And Captain Johnson, he's looking at the progress or lack of progress since the civil rights movement really kind of took flower in the 1950s and 60s, and he's feeling some despair about that. I mean, do you understand that? Do you share in that at all?
I think we still always have to grow in policing and grow in our country. And I think that when I looked at Ferguson, I think, and when I talk to people, we always have to work on it. I think that success is something that is that we lease. And every day we need to be paying rent on that. So it's never something that we own. And I think sometimes we feel that we own success and we don't. We're just leasing it, and so we always have to work at it.
Mark Simmons is a board member of the Baden Street Settlement. How do you feel about Paul's comments about his despair, about the lack of progress when it comes to sort of the racial division that he sees in this country, Mark?
So I think it's very easy at times to lose sight of the positive when fall to that place of despair that there is no change. And we all know that change at times is very slow. You know, progress can move at a very slow pace. But at the same time, progress does occur. And listening to Captain Johnson, you can see the progress that was made in Ferguson, especially after the incident took place when people had a chance to kind of settle down, kind of have an open dialogue, have a chance to speak, have a chance to gain perspectives from one another. So I think that, you know, it's important that we don't lose sight of the positive and let, you know, become succumbed to that despair.
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK if you want to join the conversation. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Captain Johnson, I haven't asked you this, and it occurs to me that I'm curious to know if you've thought about what would have happened in Ferguson if you didn't make some of the changes that you did.
You know, I always talked about what my goal was in Ferguson. When I do a presentation where I have this PowerPoint, I show my hands. And my goal, the only goal that I had, that no blood would be on my hands. And so my belief and hope is that we did the right thing and there were no lives that were lost in Ferguson after the life of Michael Brown Jr., that no protesters, no law enforcement lost their lives. And so that is what I would like to believe was the greatest success.
Yeah, you think that it could have gone a different way had you not made the changes you made.
I believe there was that possibility if we weren't starting to communicate and starting to talk and reach out to each other. And, you know, the gentleman talked about community policing. And if you looked at some of those days in Ferguson, toward the end you saw the community and police hugging and talking and doing things that we didn't see in those early days.
Well, on that subject, a listener named Shane emails to say, Evan, your guest is talking about hugging protesters, and some of the protesters were holding signs about killing cops. He shouldn't be hugging them. He should be laying down the law. What do you say to someone like Shane?
You know, and I get asked that question all the time, but when I walked down the street initially and people came out and embraced me and hugged me and I hugged them back. And, you know, in this country we have freedom of speech. And if I was going to stand there and say, because I don't like what's on your sign, I'm not going to shake your hand or I'm not going to acknowledge you, that is not standing up for the rights of this country. And so that happened. Some of those pictures of me hugging people and some of the things that were said on people's shirts, people were offended by. And I don't try to not understand that from their vantage point of what they saw. But those are the rights of our country.
Is it unfair of people like Shane who focus on, you know, some of the signs, some of the chants that we saw in Ferguson, elsewhere, but certainly not the majority of the demonstrators? The vast majority of the demonstrators are not talking about killing cops, for example. So if there's a sign, if there's a chant that happens, I certainly don't think it represents the movement. Is it unfair to focus on those things when the movement is trying to talk about substantive issues, when there might be a few in the movement who are, you know, frustrated, emotional, and taking it to that level? Is that unfair?
I would ask that you not focus on that, but I can also see why that is concerning. And so I see the balance. I see why just looking at that on TV, mm-hmm, and not being out there in the moment and really getting the feel of what the majority of the crowd was saying and doing.
Okay. Well, Shane, thanks for the email. Let me grab George in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, George.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask a question about the role of violence in social change. And we can talk about Ferguson being a different place after the violence that occurred. We could talk about Rochester being a different place after the violence in 1964. I wonder if Captain Johnson thinks that violence is a legitimate tool, especially for voiceless people, or if it's an appropriate response to institutional violence. What is the role in his mind, or is there a role for violence in social change?
George, thanks for the phone call. Captain Johnson?
I don't think violence is the key to change. While some people have that in their belief, I think the key to change is that voice, that united voice that comes out. And in Ferguson, it was a united voice. It was a diverse voice as the days went on. And I think it's that strong voice that's always created change in our country. And so it's not violence. And I think that the change that we're seeing are the small steps. It's not because buildings were burned, not because rocks were thrown. But I think it was that passion that came out. And I think it's the passion in our voice and that determination to keep coming out. In the 60s, when Martin Luther King marched, it wasn't violence that created the change. And it's not the violence that created the landmark of those days and the history of those days. It is that strong voice, and I think we need to continue to do that. And I think that, you know, we're seeing protests in our country today that are seemingly different. And it's just people standing up and being united.
Captain Johnson, what is Ferguson like today?
Ferguson is a community that's still trying to find its way. But it's a community where a lot of people are trying to get to a better place. Where people are understanding each other a little bit better. Still have a long way to go. Still some wounds to heal. But people are trying. And I think when you're trying, that there's an opportunity to succeed.
I don't seek to politicize this conversation, but I do want to ask you what you think about the fact that the person who won the presidential election during the campaign called for more national stop-and-frisk policies. Some of the pushback we heard was from cities like New York, where so-called stop-and-frisk and those kinds of policies were in place and then abandoned, and you get a good sense of the numbers. And the feeling is that generally the evidence shows that they have not worked and that they disproportionately target people of color. I'm curious to know how you feel about that, stop and frisk.
You know, I think we have to make sure we put policies in place that bring us together and not divide, and that show results that don't divide or show an imbalance. I think when we decide on how do we get there, how do we make our communities better and safer, I think the table has to be diverse. While we have to bring leaders, we have to bring those people that are part of the community, those people that have been impacted. You talked earlier about people that have said that they've gotten stopped and frisked and, mm-hmm. and those kind of things. Those people need to be at the table too. And I think when the table is diverse, then I think we can come up with applications of a law that are fair and that create a balance.
Okay. And when it comes to another form of controversy that came out of Ferguson, it wasn't just Michael Brown and the unrest that followed. It was the DOJ report looked at what they found to be, at least from correct me if I'm wrong here, but sort of a pattern of kind of arrests or stops for small violations, that all of a sudden one ticket for a small violation, a broken headlight, that kind of a thing, can spiral. Someone all of a sudden can't pay it, loses a license, can't drive, can't go to work, and that looked like it sort of disproportionately affected communities of color. Has that changed? Do you agree that that was a problem, and how do we address that?
Well, I think, you know, and throughout Missouri, our politicians have tried to get more consistency in laws and fine collections, and so it needs to be. And so a ticket for a license registration should be similar across the board. And we have to make sure that we're not creating a debtor's prison through our traffic system and our court system. And so I think that has to be a better balance. I think that is something that we saw in Ferguson. That is something that we see in other communities throughout our country. And I think that is something that we talk about leaders, that leaders have to make sure they address, and that can't happen.
Captain Ron Johnson is here. He's coming to the Baden Street Settlement, and there's a couple of events, one tonight, one tomorrow for a luncheon. And I'd like Mark Simmons, who's a member of the board of the Baden Street Settlement, to tell us about those events, how you can get involved. And then afterwards, we'll ask Captain Johnson what he plans to talk about. But Mark, people want to go. They can go tonight. They can go tomorrow. What do they need to do?
Absolutely. So tonight, the Fireside Chat begins at 6:30 at the Holiday Inn downtown. If you would like to attend, you can go to our website for ticket information. That's badenstreet.org. Again, that's badenstreet.org. Or you can contact us at 585-325-4910, extension 1140. And tomorrow, the luncheon is going to be at noon, where Captain Johnson will be the keynote speaker. And the ticket price for the luncheon is $50, and that will also be at the Holiday Inn downtown.
All right, Holiday Inn downtown. And Captain Johnson, what are you going to be talking about tonight and tomorrow?
We're going to be talking about community. We're going to be talking about purpose, value, investment. We're going to talk about the role that we play in the lives of our young citizens and throughout this country. We're going to talk about what comes about when we create partnerships and when we talk, and some of the inspirational moments that came out of Ferguson. Some of the moments that came years after Ferguson. And we're just going to talk about how, during our darkest times, how we can come together and become better. You know, I got a chance to read and Google some things about the Baden Street Settlement that were just amazing. And it just shows that since 1901, that same struggle and that same commitment that the Baden Street Settlement was started on continues today, and it always must continue, and we can never forget, and we can never stop.
I want to read a little bit about kind of what we talked about last week. We had a conversation with Spiritus Christi, a local church. They sent a race convoy to a number of cities across the American South, and they met with law enforcement. They met with people in the justice system, wanting to learn more about historical context for racial division, and then come back to Rochester, maybe better equipped with those historical issues. And Reverend Myra Brown was part of that. She was part of the conversation here. Mark, you know Reverend Brown, I assume?
I do indeed.
Yeah, she's a really dynamic speaker and a very interesting person. And one of the things that she brought up last week was that we hear about these movements and an individual incident, say it's Ferguson or say it's Eric Garner, let's say it's Ronald Scott, whatever it is. But oftentimes she says we don't understand context and that we're not really teaching context appropriately in schools. You know, kids will read a paragraph about the March on Selma, but they don't learn about the broader issues that surrounded that. Or we think about issues in places like Ferguson and others, but we need to keep broader historical issues in mind when we have those conversations. That's what Reverend Brown was saying. What do you make of that, Captain Johnson?
I think she's right. You know, when we look at Ferguson, there were so many other issues that came to bear as you walk the streets and you talk to people that were going on there. And so she's right. It becomes broader on what we have to do to fix it and make it better.
Mark, how do you feel about that?
I agree. I think that context becomes clear with communication. And I think that it's important to get that broad perspective to that open dialogue, and that's key.
So, Captain Johnson, you're in demand around the country, I imagine. You know, people want to hear from you about your experience with Ferguson. And unfortunately, since Ferguson, we've seen a number of other incidents. And speaking of that historical context, do we in the media over-report those incidents, whether it's the North Charleston, the officer who shot the man in the back who was running from him, or, unfortunately, Philando Castile? There's so many that you could point to. Do we over-report those incidents without context? You know, are you concerned that since Ferguson we've seen more of these? Is there a way to eventually that we will not see these anymore? What do you think?
I don't think you over-report. I think if you don't report it, then maybe we get this sense of that we've got success.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think we just need to make sure that when we report it, that we don't report it in this context that it includes everyone. You know, that everyone in law enforcement is doing wrong, or it's bad, or there's negative issues, or everyone in our community is doing wrong. And I think sometimes that's what happens. I think that young man or woman who's going to college or has a great job feels like, wait a minute, you're kind of pigeonholing me and as all of us as one. And policemen feel that same thing. I think we need to focus on what that issue is and where we need to get better, because there's good throughout our country. This is the best country in the world. And so I think we just need to make sure we stay focused on where we need those issues we need to address.
Okay. And if RPD called you in to say, Captain Johnson, give us a seminar on how we can do better, what are the first things you're going to do with them?
We're going to talk about understanding. We're going to talk about humanity. But we're also going to talk about shed that uniform. I tell people that I am a lot of things before I put that uniform on. I'm a lot of things. And one thing I said in Ferguson is, I am you. And I think when we forget that that's who we are, then we're lost and we can't succeed. And, you know, and a lot of times you'll run across that guy and his family will say that he's the best uncle in the world. He jokes we all love him. But then he puts his uniform on and the community says, that's the worst guy. He never smiles. Be who you are. Be who I am. And then put that uniform on.
When you were growing up, you grew up where, by the way?
I grew up about 5 minutes bike ride from Ferguson.
And so that's your community.
I mean, yes.
You know, and I know you've said, I mean, it was hard for you to see what was going on. How much racism did you experience? Do you remember experience growing up?
You know, I saw it. I mean, I've seen it and experienced it. But my parents gave me a good balance of understanding that. And I think for me going through Ferguson, I used all those experiences, some that I had really forgotten. But when I heard people say that they were experiencing that, then I knew it was true. And there's nothing wrong with using our experiences and validating what someone is telling us needs to be better.
Do you look back at your childhood and do you think, you know, you had it pretty good? Do you think that you withstood any of the racism that you witnessed? Do you think that you didn't experience as much as maybe other people of color?
I think some of the stories that I've heard in Ferguson and across this country make mine seem pretty small. And I think for me, it makes me value my parents even more than I ever have. But I also applaud them for putting me in a community that was diverse and having that relationship where I would go and talk mm-hmm. about those issues, and they were willing to talk to me about those issues and give me those right answers.
Well, let me close with a question, because I asked you, what would you say to the Rochester Police Department if they called you and said, let's do better, what are we going to do? If leaders from the Black Lives Matter movement called you, and maybe they have, and you meet with them privately and they say, what can we all do to make this better somehow? What would you say to them?
Become partners. Become partners. And when we become partners and collaborate in that way, we can succeed.
What if they said, well, we think we are. We are partners already. They can do more?
Yes, they can do more. We can do more. And I, you know, I've met people, and I, you know, doing Ferguson from the Black Lives Matters group and had some great conversations. I think they are an important group to our country. I think that they are going to play an important role in our history.
Captain Ronald Johnson is in Rochester today. He was a pivotal figure in diffusing some of the tension in Ferguson. He's been praised for his work around the country. And he is a guest of the Baden Street Settlement. BadenStreet.org? Not Baden Street Settlement, Mark. It's BadenStreet.org?
BadenStreet.org.
BadenStreet.org. Check it out online. He's got an event tonight and then the luncheon tomorrow that you can attend. And Captain Johnson, safe travels. Thanks for being here. Really appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
And our thanks to Mark Simmons, who is a member of the board of the Baden Street Settlement. Mark, thanks for making this work as well.
Thanks for having us.
Our thanks to all the people behind the glass today, who it's hard to even see everyone behind there. Is Mike Black back there? I see Mike Black. I see Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And Caitlin, are you back there too? Who else is there? Everyone's here. Have a great afternoon, and we'll catch up with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.